Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. There are lots of other NPR podcasts worth checking out, including Snap Judgment with Glenn Washington. Snap is storytelling with a beat, an intimate and musical kind of storytelling. Stories that connect, captivate, and invite you to listen closely. That's Snap Judgment. Find it on iTunes under podcasts. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we're mere days from the Oscars, and it's time for our Oscars Omnibus, where we talk about the 9 Best Picture contenders, as well as whatever other races might suit our respective fancies. And they are fancy indeed. Will it be Meryl Streep again? Will it be Matthew McConaughey? And will we get to see Jennifer Lawrence adorably take the stage? We'll cover all that, as well as what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And appropriately enough for our Oscars Omnibus, we brought with us our pal Bob Mondello. Bob Mondello, what do you do at NPR?
I review movies for All Things Considered.
We are so excited to see Bob. Now, as some of you know, Bob and I have been preparing for the Oscars with a series of little videos that we did with NPR Multimedia. And if you haven't seen them, I talked about them a couple weeks ago on the show. And we will link to them once again, but by the time you see this podcast, they should all be posted. Yeah, we've had a good time.
They have been delightful. Even I have deigned to watch them.
I had no idea what they were going to do with them. It was so weird. I thought they'd cut out all the mistakes and said, that's the whole center.
Yeah, that's pretty much mistakes.
They built it around my inability to stop laughing. I am very happy to be with all of you this week. I was away in Minnesota being dumped on by 10 inches of inhospitable snow. It was very impressive. As I was saying to some people today, when the Minnesota State Patrol tells people to stay off the roads for 3 or 4 days.
When Minnesota throws up its hands.
Minnesota threw up its hands and the State Patrol said, don't go out just for the next several days unless you absolutely have to. It was pretty inclement weather, but I was happy to see that all of you survived, thanks to our friend Kat Chow, who was here last week.
Great job.
To fill in the hole left by Stephen Thompson when Stephen Thompson filled in the hole left by me.
There's a lot of jumping through cutouts.
There certainly was. So it is almost, as people receive this podcast, it is the weekend of the leading into the Oscars, which will air this coming up Sunday night as we tape. And we wanted to, among other things, talk about the 9 movies that are nominated for Best Picture. I think the conventional wisdom, and perhaps you guys have a different sense of the conventional wisdom than I do, but I think the conventional wisdom is the Best Picture is sort of coming down to 12 Years a Slave and Gravity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that had been my sense for a while. I mean, if you remember, I said at the time Gravity will beat 12 Years a Slave. I'm not so sure about that now.
Yeah.
But the other thing that seems to be standing out to me is that the long lag between the announcements of the nominations on January 16th and the actual awards show itself on March 2nd, in part because of the Olympics, in part because the Olympics pushed it back, that it kind of has taken the air out of these a little bit.
Well, it sure has financially. These things are supposed to really boost the standing of the smaller pictures. The whole point of doing the Oscars originally was to publicize the Hollywood's great movies. That was fine when pictures stayed in theaters for 6 months at a time, but
now for a year.
They're pretty much gone within about 3 weeks,
right.
At which point this is doing nothing for like Her or for Nebraska, which is a shame because they're wonderful movies.
Yeah, Her and Nebraska and Dallas Buyers Club are all hovering around like $20 million.
Right.
And the effect it's had, I think, on their box office, I'm sure it's helped. I'm sure they'd be doing worse without it, is it's kept those movies in theaters because of the movie nerds who insist on seeing everything that's nominated.
Yeah, and there are also a lot of those films, and this was not an option at the time that the Oscars obviously began, but a lot of those films will have a much stronger life on video. I mean, a lot of them are already on demand.
Yeah, but if you don't see Gravity in the theaters, you're doing that film a disservice.
Exactly.
A huge disservice.
That's a great place to start. So, Glenn, if you think about 12 Years a Slave and Gravity as the big race,
yep.
How does that shake out in your head?
I'm kind of torn because for an advertisement for going to see a movie in a theater, from a pure cinematic experience standpoint, I think Gravity takes it. But for doing something with film that's important, that shows us something we need to see, it's 12 Years a Slave. I mean, my thing with any kind of historical drama is, why are you fictionalizing? Why aren't you telling me the actual story? And every time in 12 Years a Slave, I started to feel the presence of what seemed like some phony baloney Hollywood bullcrap. It turned out it was actually from the book.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of these. I mean, it's going to win Best Adapted Screenplay, and it deserves to, because there were moments we talked about, you know, what does this film do that a documentary wouldn't? You wouldn't get that scene where he's hanging, or almost about hanging, which conveys something, which does something in a very emotional, powerful way. You wouldn't get the scene with Alfre Woodard, I don't think.
That's a wonderfully interesting
which
scene.
He's allowed to sit there and sort of radiate meanings in a lot of different directions simultaneously. It's not, you're not told what to feel in that moment. I really think it deserves to win at least screenplay, possibly best picture.
Yeah.
As far as the race between 12 Years a Slave and Gravity goes, what Gravity has going for it, just from a horse racy standpoint, is it has a little bit more of what I call the Hollywood's love affair with the movies syndrome, where it has a little bit more like kind of a sprinkling of movie magic.
Yeah.
And if you look at a lot of the Best Picture winners in recent years, movies like The Artist, I mean, Hugo didn't win Best Picture, but Hugo had, it was just the whole, it was, had this long lecture about film preservation in
it does.
You know, that movies that are stand-ins for Argo. Argo is a giant mash note to Hollywood. Yeah. As much as I love that movie, Gravity feels a little bit more movie. Yeah. You know,
well, totally. It's kinetic. The whole thing is just, it's fun to watch. My hassle with 12 Years a Slave is kind of that it's, I felt as if an awful lot of it was sledgehammer subtle, and that, not that you can do a subtle movie about that necessarily, but it felt like they were really hitting us over the head with things, and it certainly worked. I was awash at the end of the picture. I didn't feel that way about Gravity. Gravity kept on fighting it. I was really fighting that script. I thought that script was really annoying.
There are some weaknesses in the script, which I talked about when we covered this movie the first time. And for me, I think the battle between 12 Years a Slave and Gravity is an interesting opportunity to ask whether there's a difference between the best piece of art and the best piece of filmmaking.
Right.
Because I think 12 Years a Slave may be the best piece of art, or Her might be.
Yeah.
But Gravity is the best piece of filmmaking. And this is why Cuarón is an okay choice for me for best director. Mm-hmm. If you look at this and you say, who has really figured out how to maximize the opportunities of what is happening in filmmaking right now, you have to look at Gravity. Whereas a lot of the other ones are pieces of art more generally. They're not as you sort of said when you were talking about A Salute to the Movies, they're not as specifically demonstrative of mastery of technical aspects of kind of very, very current stuff going on in film. And that's not to take anything away from the directing of 12 Years a Slave, which there have been a couple of really good pieces written about how deceptively well directed that film is, in a way that has kind of gotten washed out by the conversation that Glenn was having about that it's important.
Right. I do think Alfonso Cuarón will win Best Director, the way that Ang Lee won Best Director for Life of Pi.
Yeah, I think that's
it happens sometimes. On the other hand, you know, Hollywood has a really strange history with this kind of thing. 2001 was not even nominated for Best Picture that year. Right. Oliver won. Excuse me, Oliver.
That's amazing.
It's like, how crazy is that? And 2001 wasn't nominated. It's sometimes they just don't get it. And I think
this is a very, very, very mainstream softball, right up the middle.
In terms of Gravity, I mean?
Yeah, Gravity.
Yeah. So, Stephen, you talked about your love of Her, which you've talked about before. We didn't wind up devoting a whole segment to this particular movie. So why don't you talk a little bit about where that movie kind of hit you?
First of all, it hit me somewhat in the Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind place, which is a very vaunted place in my mind. I mean, you talk about stealth great filmmaking and visual invention, the way people talk about how visually inventive Gravity is. There are sneaky bits of incredibly sleek and inventive filmmaking in Her, which I just found to be a beautiful and thoughtful piece of very plausible science fiction about a near future in which everyone's needs are so specifically met by technology that they don't have the ability to process other people's needs anymore. And I thought that was such an interesting take on technology that was not handled in a, what I felt was a particularly heavy-handed manner.
Yeah.
And you have these scenes in that movie, and some of the criticisms I've heard of that movie revolve around its portrayals of women.
Mm-hmm.
There are female characters in that movie who are very ungenerously portrayed.
Yeah.
And yet they serve in part to highlight, and Joaquin Phoenix's character is no different, this sort of stating of needs that go right past the person that they're talking to.
Yeah.
That movie just really haunted me and stuck with me, and I thought about it for weeks and weeks.
Yeah. Bob, what did you think of Her?
I flipped. I thought it was absolutely gorgeous. And I think it's interesting that it's been attacked on the basis of the women characters. We don't get to meet the, is it Amy Adams' computer?
Right.
So had we gotten to meet him, presumably, it would...
It's a Her.
I think it's a Her.
It was a Her.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I take it back. Well, then
She's having a lesbian affair with the computer.
I can't defend it then.
I think that what I said when I heard those criticisms, which were sort of, it mostly revolves around this Scarlett Johansson voice performance as the OS that isn't very fully fleshed out. And my reaction was, of course it's not. It's not a woman. It's not a person. It is a computer. And it's really important. I think it is a movie about love, and it is a movie about feelings, and it is a movie about a relationship. But at the same time, that is not a person. And it's kind of a thing that I've always been fascinated by, is this idea of, would you really want a person who was invented to your specifications? Because would that limit their ability to be surprising or to be different than you expected or to be challenging to you? And I think the push-pull in the movie is a little bit about the Joaquin Phoenix character's sense that he loves the fact that this OS is built for him. It's
right.
not, it does not exist independent of him. You know, eventually there is a sense of kind of a growing autonomy in Her, it, whatever.
And that's what I think was a very, very clever maneuver. Again, without giving too much away, I had really dreaded that this movie was going to go in one direction, and it went another, in terms of giving that character, that Scarlett Johansson character, more agency than you expect.
Mm-hmm.
And to have it ultimately evolve into a relationship where you have, again, needs battering against each other.
Yeah. It's a relationship, and it isn't a relationship. It is a sort of a play acting. It's a sort of a simulacrum of a relationship, because it's not people. There's no meeting of souls and minds. There is a very, very good computer program.
I spent the whole movie feeling like that was absolutely accurate to the way that people interact, though.
Sure.
You know, that there was nothing about the push-pull, the nurturing followed by the pulling away, all those kinds of things that don't happen in real relationships. And it becomes so unnerving,
right,
in that it's that you start to think, okay, what is it that I see in my partner that is somehow separate from all the things I think I see in my partner? It's weird.
All right, grumpy pants.
All right, so you know how sometimes you're out walking around the city and you want a cup of coffee, you want a cup of Joe, hot cup of Joe. And so you go into a coffee shop. And it's not a coffee shop you've been in before. And it's got, you know, very little twinkly lights and ethereal music playing very, very softly, you know.
I wouldn't
go
in there.
It's sort of like atonal Yanni, you know, and you go up to the counter.
Are you telling me that you go into coffee shops with Yanni and twinkle lights? I think you are lying.
You go up to the counter, and the guy has like arm garters, and he's got a vest and like a watch fob.
You've already left,
And he's got some kind of facial hair going on, which I'm sure he thinks makes him seem fascinating. And you say, "Give me a cup of Joe, give me a cup of coffee," and he goes, "1 minute, sirrah," or something like that. And he brings out like all this apparatus, because it turns out this is one of those drip coffee places that takes 8 minutes for you to get your little coffee that comes in a demi-tasse cup, like a thimble. And so you're like, no, I'm fine. And you just want to pay the guy, grab your coffee, and get out of there. But
he's going somewhere.
You can't, because he's in the back watching kitten videos on YouTube and crying a single tear, because the world is a beautiful place, man.
Yeah.
That is this film. Oh. There is such a hushed preciousness to it, which of course is completely intentional. This is exactly what Spike Jonze is going for, and that's what he does. Now, people call this film, you know, a romantic comedy, which is a joke.
No.
Because it's not, but it is a romance. As such, it's a film that I would never go and see because it's half of it is spent with just charming, idiosyncratic people having charming, idiosyncratic dates. And then the last half of the film is them, you know, just apologizing to each other because they hurt each other's feelings. Something needed to happen in this film besides feelings being hurt. To its credit, the fact that it's one of them is a computer system, it still felt like a boring movie. You just need to drop Joe Pesci into the middle of this film, airdrop Joe Pesci something happen. The scenes in the film where he's playing the video game and the animated dude starts saying foul things, it just shakes this film out of its complacency. It's very, I thought, self-satisfied complacency. Just one tiny, bloody robot uprising. They must be happening somewhere. I don't need the film to be about that, but just show it.
Well, that's
it
where
off
all the people
the
went.
Side.
Everything's very,
that's
very
exactly right.
Sparsely populated.
I mean, I love the world he built. I just wanted to take the camera away from this really boring dude and go look at something else.
Uh-huh.
Did not care
for
this film.
I think they did that in I Am Robot.
Yeah, well, I Robot. Yes, yes,
yeah,
they did.
Yeah, I Robot, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, oh my God, man. I've seen criticisms of this film that have sort of been like, this film is all about deifying this, you know, whatever the Manic Pixie Dream Girl equivalent of boys is, you know, this sad twee man with high-waisted pants and a mustache who has feelings. I don't think it glorifies him. I think it's very honest about his considerable shortcomings and what would make him susceptible to falling in love with a computer.
Yeah, well, I mean, it did that effectively because I didn't want to spend any time.
Because that's not the movie you wanted to see.
No. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, fair enough. Okay, so another one that was originally in the mix for Best Picture that I think is sort of out of the mix is American Hustle.
Yeah.
So, Bob, what is your position on American Hustle?
Well, I really liked it, but I saw it the same day that I saw Wolf of Wall Street, which I really didn't like. Mm-hmm. And so I thought it's the one I thought was fun. The thing I came away from it with thinking after the nominations were announced, was that if you're an actor and you don't want to work for David O. Russell, you're nuts because he gets everybody Oscar nominations. I mean, 2 years in a row to get all four categories.
As he did for Silver Linings.
Is just astonishing. And I think that the picture is enormous fun and very cleverly done. I mean, any movie that is going to be about appearances and that starts with a comb over has really thought things through in an interesting way. And I thought it was gorgeous to watch.
But I do feel like your praise of it just now is a little more muted than it was when you initially saw it. This was your favorite movie of the year at one point.
Yeah, it was for a little bit. See, my problem is that the picture I liked best this year didn't get nominated for Best Picture.
What was the picture you liked best this year?
The Past. The Arrival.
Oh, yeah. I loved it.
Which it threw me for a loop. This one is artificial and fun and took me places I wasn't expecting to go a couple of times. I mean, there were some scenes in there that I just thought, where did that come from? Was that completely improvised? Then the ending, I wasn't expecting at all. So I had a great time at the movie. And you're right, I'm more muted about it now.
Didn't stick with you maybe as much.
And that is something that I have encountered talking to people about this movie a bunch of times. There's a bit of a cotton candy quality to it where it sort of dissolves and dries up.
The performances don't necessarily, the story does. I couldn't tell you what happened in it. But, you know, I was surprised by two performances in it. Bradley Cooper is at his best, I now realize, when playing a complete tool.
I don't like that you're in jail while he's going free. I don't like any of that. I want to help you. All the razzle-dazzle that he does, it's not good. It's not real. It's fake. It's not real. Who you are is who you are between you and God. You and your soul. That's what matters. That's what counts. That's what I'm about.
And he's sort of in his wheelhouse here playing a complete tool. Christian Bale has never made me laugh once. He's got an actorly intensity to him. Yeah. I mean, he made me laugh when he went, oh, swear to me, in Batman, because that was just silly. But there are line readings in this film. He says at one point, I got a plan, that actually I was laughing at something that Christian Bale said. That never happened. He actually threw himself into the role in a way that really, I didn't think he had much left in him, and he really does.
It's funny you talk about them because I thought the women were the ones who were really amazing in the picture.
Yeah.
My
sense of this movie, I just didn't care about any of these people. I didn't care about the plot. I didn't care about any of this stuff except the Jennifer Lawrence character.
Right.
But there's this top coat that you can only get from Switzerland, and I don't know what I'm going to do because I'm running out of it, but I love the smell of it. Irvin, I can't get enough of it. That would be amazing. There's something, the top coat, it's like perfumey, but there's also something rotten. And I know that sounds crazy, but I can't get enough of it. But smell it, it's true.
I wanted a whole movie about her, and I kind of, she's there, but she's actually kind of she's a seasoning in this movie. And I wanted the movie to be about her. And I, as much as I like Amy Adams, and I've liked Amy Adams in a bunch of different things, and I think because she started off doing a few happy, happy performances. Right. There has been a misunderstanding that she can only do that. Whereas if you've seen her in something like The Master,
oh, yeah.
she has many other sides. And so I don't like to be critical of a performance where she did something different. But I just felt like in this particular one, I just didn't care about that character. I'm not sure that I liked the script of this movie very
well,
much.
Again, they're all awful. They're just terrible people.
Yeah,
and so you're not actually supposed to empathize with them particularly. Right.
It's more be interested in.
Well, and the closest you come, I think, the closest I came to empathizing was Jeremy Renner's character, who is essentially somebody who is a villain that people are attempting to bring down.
Yeah.
And Glenn in particular has really pounded on Jeremy Renner on this show. I believe you called him a potato-nosed bag of bland.
Yeah, bowl of bland.
Bowl of bland. Yeah. I thought this was a really nice, nuanced performance where I ultimately found his character very compelling. But I had a little bit of the same reaction of walking out like, that had a lot of electricity to it, a lot of energy, and then it just went
Like you were saying, I think this is an interesting crop of movies for sort of which ones you keep thinking about. Like, I've thought about 12 Years a Slave many, many times since I saw it. I've thought about Her many times since I saw it. I don't think I've thought about American Hustle once since I saw it.
How about Wolf of Wall Street?
Bob, you were not a fan of Wolf of Wall Street.
It's electric filmmaking. I felt engaged by it every second, and I hated the characters so much that it was really hard to watch them. And it's really hard to think of why I should be paying attention to them on a movie screen blown up to bigger than life.
I mean, I think Martin Scorsese specializes in portraying communities and hierarchies of men. He's very interested in how men swagger against each other.
Right.
I am less so. And I go and I'm sitting there and I think, you know, this is all right. Feels like they're about to take it in for a landing. And it had been an hour and 15 minutes.
And it's a three-hour movie.
I wasn't even halfway there.
I dug this film a lot, actually. I mean, it's too long. I'm not saying anything that other people haven't said and will continue to say until the end of time. This film is too long. I like Scorsese when he's making a comedy. King of Comedy is probably one of my favorite Scorsese films. In dramatic scenes where you let your actors improv, they're kind of finding the character when they do that. But in comedies, I'm not saying you need to end it on a joke. It needs to build. Mm-hmm. And he is very enamored of these particular actors. He just points a camera at them. And scenes that should end far sooner than they do just keep going on and on and on, milking what is not funny to try to come to this weird anti-comedy place. But that didn't always happen, because like the scene where he gets into the car, which I've heard many, many people say, that scene went on forever, I hated it. I could have watched that for another 20 minutes. I just think there's, I should note that I saw this 15 minutes after I saw Her, and this was the perfect antidote to Her. It was like, finally.
That's it.
It sounds like it, doesn't it?
It's kind of the opposite of what had happened with Bob Mondello and watching Wolf of Wall Street at the same time you saw American Hustle.
Yeah.
There are just entire gaping scenes in that movie where I just thought, why is this there?
Yeah.
All that stuff about their gay butler who throws a party.
Yeah.
Like, what is that doing there? What happened?
There's nothing like hearing people randomly drop parts of a movie that you haven't seen. All that stuff about the gay butler throwing a party, I want to see it right now. I want to see it. You made it sound great.
None of you were troubled by the whole idea that he's holding these reprobates up for admiration, right? I mean,
that's obviously preposterous.
Obviously, on the face of it. I mean, I can't imagine anybody coming, unless you're a 14-year-old boy.
You know, I don't feel either that it is holding these people up for admiration. The one argument that I felt watching the credits of that movie is the fact that they give Jordan Belfort a bit part in this movie.
Right.
That feels endorsey to me.
To me, it's just like, here's the jerk.
No,
here he is.
I get what Steven's saying, though. There's a relationship that you have with a subject when he's kind of part of making the movie.
Yeah, his cooperation. You're basing it on his book.
Mm-hmm.
I think this movie may be the primary competition for 12 Years a Slave for Best Adapted Screenplay. Mm. There's so much monologuing. There's so many juicy gobbets of dialogue in this movie. I would not be surprised if this upset.
So you have Wolf of Wall Street with a nomination for Leonardo DiCaprio,
who is, I think, terrific in it.
Who is up against, among other people, Matthew McConaughey in Dallas Buyers Club. Steven, you were a big fan of the Matthew McConaughey performance in Dallas Buyers Club.
Yeah, I think that Dallas Buyers Club as a film is largely Matthew McConaughey.
Arigato.
What are you doing here?
Well, I live here.
Where's Rayon? Your roommates?
Not exactly. What are you doing here?
Roger Thompson. This is my patient. You treating these people?
Oh, they're treating themselves.
With what?
Vitamins, peptide T, DDC, anything but that poison you're hawking. Say, you ever wear any color? Seems like every time I see you, all I see is white. You got white coat, white shoes, white...
Tell Rayon I was looking for him, and I am telling my patients to stay away from here.
Why?
Excuse me.
Say, you want to go grab steak sometime? I know it's red.
To that extent, it is a terrific movie because I think that Matthew McConaughey is so incredibly electric and charismatic in it. You get to see a character evolve over the course of the picture. I think that as much as I love the McConaughey, I don't quite get the passion for the Jared Leto performance.
Yeah. I agree. I completely agree. The only thing that I took away from the Jared Leto performance that I did think was impressive is that Jared Leto is an actor that I have known for a long time.
Right, because of My So-Called Life.
Because of My So-Called Life and pretty much just that. But I've known that guy a long time. And he is kind of a famous boyfriend, right? And by the end of that movie, I did think of that character as a woman. That's a hard thing to do. And granted, he's taking advantage of a certain softness in his appearance. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I saw this movie that I realized how much part of his heartthrobbiness was a very, very common thing in heartthrobs of teenage girls, which is a certain lovely, soft quality that makes it easier for him to play a woman than it would be for some other kinds of actors. And so I was able to stop and say, yes, by the end of this movie, I understood this character was a woman. And that is, you know, that's not an easy feat.
Do you like this dress? Because I think the neckline's a little plunging.
Rayon, the whole purpose of this study is to determine if ACT is helping people.
Come on, Evie, you know there ain't no helping me.
That doesn't mean I'm going to stop trying.
Why are you so good to me? Bless your little heart.
Just promise me you'll show up for the rest of the trial.
I promise you that I will try my very best.
I want you to mean it.
Beyond that, I just wasn't sure there was all that much to that performance. And I do think that's an example of a, I don't want to say stunt because it's not, I don't mean it quite
it
that
just,
derisively.
I think just Oscars-y.
But a kind of a...
like that's a bad thing.
Yeah, but a kind of a feat that someone has performed more than the performance itself. Other than the fact that it's a man playing a woman, which has its own problems, right? People have brought up
that they did
the
not
casting
cast
issue.
A trans
Why
actor.
Didn't you cast a trans woman, since that would have perhaps been the way to go? But other than that, I agree with Stephen that I don't know if I love that performance.
Well, as for the film itself, I mean, it seemed, I was impressed by it, but it set out to impress. You called it Oscars-y. This film felt like that to me. It also felt very, forgive me, but tidy. The arc that this character goes through, from raging homophobe to, you know, very accepting dude. You talk about why make this a film instead of a documentary, because if you made it a documentary, apparently the dude wasn't a homophobe. And in fact, some people say he was actually bisexual himself. So if you're going to tell this guy's story, tell this guy's story. Don't overlay this fakey character arc where somebody learns something. I mean, that just felt fake. Also, the character of Rayon, the character of the doctor played by Jennifer Garner, all composites. It's just, what is this for?
I mean, I think that's an interesting point about why make him that much less likable in the beginning of the movie. What I found fascinating about his transformation was not that he necessarily that he goes from raging homophobe to champion. It's the survival instinct as he weaves through the world that is worn in that performance in a really marvelous way.
And you know, while we're on the topic of Dallas Buyers Club, I did want to mention one other thing, which is something that I read about, which is that the makeup budget for that movie was $250.
For Dallas Buyers Club?
Really? Mm-hmm.
Wow. And they're nominated for it. There's a great story, we'll link to it, about how they did the makeup in that movie on this very, very small budget. Because, of course, not only did she have to... The makeup artist was explaining that because of the way they shot the movie, both Jared Leto and Matthew McConaughey had lost all this weight, but you couldn't wait for them to kind of gain and lose it as you were shooting the movie, because over the course of the movie, sometimes they're healthier, sometimes they're less healthy. So she had to be able to kind of make them seem plumper and healthier. Or more gaunt. And she talked about the little things that she did to achieve that. And there was a moment in this movie where I actually sat there and I thought, whoever did the makeup in this movie has very briefly created the illusion that not only is Matthew McConaughey ill, right, unwell, but that he's kind of not that good looking of a dude. Mm. And it's extremely hard, even with makeup. No, I'm serious, though. Even with makeup, it's very difficult to actually make a very good looking person with a very symmetrical face to sort of think like, yeah, he doesn't look like any great shakes right now.
A similar transformation, it's up against Bad Grandpa. Now, which do you prefer?
I don't know. Okay, so we have a couple left. We did talk about Captain Phillips when it was out. I was a little bit surprised, actually, at the Oscars haul for this movie. I would have been less surprised by a Tom Hanks nomination. I was more surprised by a Best Picture nomination.
Yeah, mm-hmm. When you talk to people about this film, they'll say it's solid. But everybody talks about the last 5 minutes, mm-hmm. which is a performance by Tom Hanks. Mm-hmm. And I have a feeling that
he wasn't nominated.
Those last 5 minutes elevated this film. People, yeah. I mean, you yeah. when you think back about this,
when you walk out of the theater, you
that's
have those.
What you are. That's what you're focused
I have to
on.
Say the thing I'm thinking. When I was watching that movie, I kept on thinking how all through the beginning of it, how do four high school student age people in a little tiny boat take over a tanker? It doesn't make any sense to me. And as I was watching the thing, watching the logistics of it
yeah.
were fascinating. I thought that yeah. In terms of direction,
yeah.
it's amazing.
It's
and
a Paul
I just,
Greengrass, yeah.
The, oh, my God.
Yeah.
It was so cool at the beginning. I thought that the last 20 minutes of the picture, when it becomes a Navy SEAL movie, is simply...
less interesting.
Yeah,
to you.
Just
yeah.
not nearly as interesting.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. When we talked about the movie, I think Stephen talked about the fact that the military segment was not so interesting.
Right. For me, I mean, Tom Hanks wasn't nominated because there were 5 slots.
Right.
Captain Phillips was nominated because there were 9. I felt like this was a lot of people's 7th favorite movie of the year, which made me actually extra surprised that it was nominated for Best Picture, because it has to get 5%
yeah.
first place votes.
Yeah.
And I kind of felt a little bit like the way, remember a few years ago when Moneyball was nominated?
Yeah, we talked about it.
And I was like,
it.
Moneyball's mm-hmm. terrific, but is it the, like 5% of the voters said it was the best movie of the year?
Yeah.
They all worked on it.
The interesting thing about Captain Phillips, and when we talked about Captain Phillips, our pal Chris Klimek was here and had talked about the quality of that boat chase sequence and how amazing that sequence is. The thing I like about this nomination is that it kind of like with Gravity, I feel like this one is about the ability to make a movie, you know. And then we have two left, and they are both about older people discovering kind of relationships relationships with kids and with their pasts. And the first one is Nebraska, directed by Alexander Payne and starring Bruce Dern and Will Forte. Bob, what do you think of Nebraska?
Nebraska is kind of a gorgeous comedy in black and white, set in the middle of the country, and that feels entirely natural to me. As I was watching it, I thought, well, it feels like reality probably feels if you're wandering around there. I sort of recognized the characters. I believed it. Mm-hmm. I thought the performances were lovely. I can't get enough of June Squibb. I wanted her to make 5 more movies like right now. And I liked it a lot.
Wonderful. Glenn, Nebraska.
Well, I mean, there is an arid deliberateness to this film. I mean, if
arid deliberateness,
we see these two characters go out of their house and down their driveway and get in their truck and then back out the car of the truck and get on the highway and then not talk, because that's the whole point, and then drive up to the bar and then get out of the truck and then go into the bar and sit down. It's like, give me a whip pan. Give me a star wipe. I get it.
Robot uprising.
Holy crap. I mean, I thought that there should have been in the credits something like Mr. Dern's nose hair styled by Mr. Antoine. Or Nasal Merkins by Dicker and Dicker of Beverly Hills. Like, it's huge on the screen. It's, God, it was just...
Wow.
But I also don't get the love for June Squibb. She was perfectly fine, but I don't... She's getting all this attention. And here's the thing that it really occurred to me just a couple minutes ago, which is that if you spent any time in a fiction workshop in the last 50 years, you've read this story. And it works great as a short story with its tiny little epiphany, its little moment of compassion that it's very fleeting, but man, it feels very formulaic, very stock. Mm. I want to like Alexander Payne more than I do. I mean, I loved Election, but ever since then, he's been backing away from the funny to get to this more sort of character study thing. It just doesn't work for me.
I liked this movie, and there are details in this movie that I thought were so terrific, and the way some of these characters are realized, and some of the scenes in which people are interacting in incredibly mundane ways, I thought were beautifully realized. I love the fact that every time somebody says something to Bruce Dern's character, his reply is, "What?" Which, if you've had a relative like that, I love like the bit of the cousins who have so little to say that they just keep coming back to how long it took to get from Billings to Hawthorne.
But how long total?
Couple days, I guess.
From Billings?
Yeah.
How far is that?
Probably about 750 miles.
It took you 2 days to drive 750 miles? Were you driving a dump truck or something?
It's a Subaru Outback.
Hell, I drove up from Dallas one time. That's 850 miles. I'd done that in 8 hours.
That's like over 100 miles an hour.
Oh, Bart was moving.
Those are the things that I think bring it to life or brought it to life for me. It is an interesting movie to consider in light of its performances because I like the Bruce Dern performance a lot. Bruce Dern is given in this movie a lot of very appealing, great performance-y things to say. And the way I thought about this movie, interestingly enough, as somebody who watched Will Forte do a lot of Saturday Night Live and a lot of really silly stuff, I was really pleased with this performance. And to throw in a little tiny note, which is perhaps of interest only to me, but he's trying to get over the loss of his girlfriend. She is a plus-sized lady.
Right.
This is uncommented upon. She's not played for pathos. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She's not played for that it's a joke that he likes her or that it makes anything about him sad that he likes her. It's just a little tiny
note,
but it was a detail that really startled me and caught my attention. In terms of June Squibb, I think she's great, but I also think there's an element of something that I want to talk about with the other movie, Philomena, starring Judi Dench, which is there is part of me that bristles at the adorabilizing of older women.
Right. Mm.
And that bristles when 20-year-olds call 75-year-old women adorable. And I don't like it when they do it with June Squibb. I don't like it when they do it with Judi Dench. And I don't like it when they do it with Maggie Smith.
I don't think it's necessarily that the June Squibb character is played as adorable. I didn't feel like it was portrayed as particularly cute, even though you have scenes like the one in the graveyard.
Where's your family?
Oh, they're over in the Catholic cemetery. Catholics wouldn't be caught dead around all these damn Lutherans. Here's Delmer, Woody's cousin. He was a drunk. One time we were wrestling and he felt me up. Grabbed a handful of boob and Woody was right there and didn't have a clue, did you, Woody?
It's a much more outward, much goofier scene. But you also have just these wonderful little details. The scene where she asks what to order on the menu and then orders the thing that is not what she's told. She does that kind of several times. I felt that there were subtleties to that character and subtleties to that performance.
Well, I feel like in Philomena, Judi Dench, the performance of Judi Dench and the writing of the character of Philomena is a story about a woman who, when she's very young, when she's a teenager, essentially, she gets pregnant in Ireland. Her family sends her off to a convent where after she has the baby, she is forced to remain and work. And they eventually give the baby away. And so many, many, many years later, a journalist played by Steve Coogan tries to come and help her see if she can figure out what happened to the son. I think the writing of the character of Philomena usually is on the right side of the line between adorableness and, you know. But there are times when it tips over into that point where I think there's a little bit of cutesiness in the writing of the character. And I like the movie a lot better when they're not doing that.
And all that cutesiness is in the trailer. Philomena seems, from the trailers, like it's going to be lighter than it is.
Yeah. It's a very sad movie in places. Bob, what did you think of Philomena?
I thought Steve Coogan was amazing. I thought Judi Dench's performance was nice and subtle and a little sweeter than I wanted it to be. And my problem with that was basically alleviated because Steve Coogan's on hand all the time to say something wrong.
They've got omelets over there.
Thank you.
Pancakes and waffles, any filling, and cereal, bacon and sausage, anything you want.
I saw.
Breakfast is included, isn't it?
It is. It's just that it's too early for me. My stomach hasn't woken up yet.
Mine wakes up before I do. I'm having a ham and Swiss cheese omelet. Will I get you one?
I'm not hungry.
What about some blueberries?
I'd
coffee?
Be, No, thank you.
Okay, well, if you want to help yourself to breakfast over there, we have two buffets, hot and cold, fresh fruit, cereal.
She just told me.
Omelets with your choice of filling.
I know exactly what's on display over there.
We also have fresh pancakes.
Thank you. Trying to have a private conversation.
Mm-hmm. And to sort of take us out of it.
To dump a little vinegar on the scene.
Well, not just to be acerbic, but also to get things wrong towards the end of the picture.
Yeah.
And that she becomes a much more substantial character is precisely because he doesn't get it.
Right, exactly.
And so I thought that was interesting.
Exactly.
Right. Variety called this film a smug but effective middlebrow crowd pleaser, which, I mean, check yourself, Di, because if you were talking smug, that's pot calling the kettle smug right there.
Yeah.
I went into it dreading it because I figured it would be like, you know, this is one of those films that your mom loves. Oh, we loved it. We thought it was super. But the presence of Steve Coogan, this guy improves everything. He actually co-wrote the screenplay with Jeff Pope. He excels at playing vain schmucks. So the fact that we have this vain schmuck in this film doing exactly what you're saying, Bob, it leavens the film. It takes away the sweetness. And, you know, there are moments when the film flirts, as you mentioned, Linda, with condescending toward the character in the same way that Steve Coogan's character condescends towards her.
Right, right.
And there is, at the very end of the film, a little mustache twirling that goes on, a little bit on this mustache twirling that just didn't seem a little over the line.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this is a film that my mom and I could enjoy together. I mean, for different reasons. But I really was surprised at how much I liked this
film. Yeah, I liked it a lot.
So the performances are a little bit more restrained, and we talked on a previous episode about how if you're going to play an unlikable character, you'd better do it really loudly if you want to be nominated for an Oscar, which is how you wind up with, I mean, August Osage County, which is just actors yelling at each other for two awful hours. And this has less of that. It is a more restrained movie, and I admired it for that. It did not stick with me as long as some of the others.
So, Stephen, if you had to pick a Best Picture, what would you pick?
I'd say 12 Years a Slave.
Bob?
12 Years a Slave.
Glenn?
Gravity for spectacle, 12 Years a Slave for filmmaking.
Yeah, but what's going to win?
What's going to win is Gravity, I think.
Do you think? It's between 12 Years a Slave and Her for me in terms of my particular
It was very play. Much between those two movies.
And I think I would still pick 12 Years a Slave. It's just too, it does too many things well for me to not pick that one. But we also just wanted to very quickly mention that, you know, there are also a bunch of other races to watch. Glenn has seen a bunch of the documentaries.
Yeah.
Which is your favorite of the documentaries?
Huh. Well, my favorite is 20 Feet from Stardom,
which doesn't
have a chance in hell because it's up against... It doesn't have a chance because it's up against The Act of Killing, which has an incredible pedigree. It's Werner Herzog, Errol Morris, and Joshua Oppenheimer making a film about the 1965 military coup in Indonesia, getting the leaders of all these death squads to reenact their horrible crimes on film.
As musicals and as gangster pictures, it is the strangest documentary I've ever seen in my life.
It's a very strange movie, and I don't buy the end of it for reasons we can't get into here, but I don't go into that film with a lot of faith in humanity. I come out with a lot less.
Yeah.
But there are no Holocaust films in this list, which means this...
It's wide open.
That skews it a bit.
The closest you get both to a Holocaust and to the magic of the movies is Act of Killing. I think it's the odds-on favorite.
Yeah. So undoubtedly, you all have many, many thoughts about the Oscars, and come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. And let us know what you're thinking about the Oscars and the Best Picture nominees. And that brings us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
All weekend long on Netflix, while I kind of ran in and out of the room to listen to music while I prepare for South by Southwest, the kids and I streamed on Netflix the Animal Planet series My Cat from Hell.
You would.
Which features a sort of L.A. rocker complete with kind of rockabilly clothes and silly facial hair named Jackson Galaxy.
Oh, yes. Oh, that guy.
Who I like Jackson Galaxy.
Okay.
Who comes in and he, you know, you see all the scenes of the cat misbehaving horribly and are always told the incredibly high stakes. You know, we can't have a baby while the cat is bad. You know, we are going to break up because the cat is bad. Just, everybody will be killed because the cat is bad. And then he goes through and gives all sorts of helpful tips, and by the end you have a lovable, snuggly pussycat. I don't spend as much time just mainlining hours upon hours upon hours of like Animal Planet type programming, but I walked away from it with a bunch of incredibly useful tips on how to keep my cats from pissing everywhere. And I really enjoyed the show, and it was just popcorn, and it was just on all weekend.
Fantastic. Thank you, Stephen Thompson. Bob Mondello, what's making you happy this week?
I got a new Roget's Thesaurus. I know that sounds idiotic. I am so excited. It's not a new one,
actually. Are you just excited, or else are you also ecstatic?
I am ecstatic. I am fervid. I am fervent. I am... oh, my God. No, I went to a place called The Book Thing in Baltimore. I had never heard of it before. And they have a warehouse full of books, maybe 100,000 books, and they give them away. And you can make donations. I tried to make a donation of dollars, and they wouldn't accept it. You can bring in books to give away. You sign a promise that you're not going to sell them anywhere, right. But otherwise this is a free book. Well, I went in there, and in the reference section, they had a bunch of Roget's Thesauruses, as of course they would, and they had a whole bunch of the fifth edition, which is worthless, as everybody who uses thesauruses knows. And
it's all antonyms instead.
And they had a fourth edition, which is the last time it was any good. And I am very excited. This is heaven. So I now have a copy here, and my stuff on NPR is going to be my stuff. See, I need a thesaurus. I need a thesaurus. It's going to be much more articulate.
That's wonderful, Bob.
I'm very excited.
Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week, sir?
Trey is not here, so three things. RuPaul's Drag Race is coming back. This is a show that, if you hate reality television, this show embraces everything that you hate about reality television and makes fun of it while also doing it. So it's the best of both worlds. It's so smart about what it is, and it's a lot of fun. Emily Nussbaum's take on True Detective in The New Yorker, called Cool Story, Bro, which is a great title. You know, it's gotten a lot of attention on social media today, mostly because of what she says about the show's attitude toward women, or its ignoring of women as characters, which is perfectly right. What's not getting enough attention, I think, is her analysis that the show seems to be holding up the character played by Matthew McConaughey as this laconic masculine ideal. Mm-hmm. And that's not the show I signed on for. It's having one of the characters' views of the world kind of constantly dashed and the others constantly reaffirmed. Mm-hmm. And that's throwing the show way out of balance in a way. That's a really smart take. I recommend you read it. But the thing that's really making me happy this week is an episode of Girls called Beach House. I haven't been keeping up with the show, so I dropped back in on this one episode. And if you haven't been keeping up with the show and you want to see what's going on there, drop in on this episode. It is a great 28 minutes of American television. She knows her characters. We can empathize with them and still find them fatuous and foolish. And there are jokes. And the beach house is amazing. This incredible beach house that this entire episode takes place in, basically a bottle episode. But man, it's a lot of fun. And really, this show is, I think, firing on all cylinders and made me want to go back and watch the entire season.
Fantastic. Thank you, Glenn Weldon. My first very quick thing is that Alec Baldwin wrote this really long thing it was an as told to. In New York Magazine, where he explained why he hates the paparazzi and is never going to talk about his life again in public ever again. And one of the things that he was talking about was being called a homophobe by Andrew Sullivan. And so Andrew Sullivan wrote about this today, and Andrew Sullivan's headline was, "Exit Alec Baldwin Pursued by a Bear," which I think is
pretty good.
A shockingly, amazingly great headline. And I doff my cap because it's unbelievably great. The other thing making me happy this week, I just finished listening to the over 20-hour audiobook of John Grisham's Sycamore Row, which is his current bestseller. And, you know, I dip in and out with Grisham. I have not read all of it. I have read some and not others. I tend to kind of wait until I'm in the mood for another one, at which point it's usually 5 books ago that I last read one. I listened to this, and it's quite a good book. I enjoyed the book a lot. But the real reason to listen to this audiobook is not just the book that he's written, but the performance of a guy named Michael Beck, who is reading this audiobook. It is, no question, a feat of acting.
The noose was straight from the textbook, with 13 coils designed to collapse the loop under pressure. A true hangman's knot snaps the neck, making death quicker and less painful. And apparently, Seth had done his homework.
It's similar to what I have said before about Bobby Cannavale's reading of Lush Life. In this, you have a guy who is doing characters in this Mississippi, in this Grisham's kind of favorite Mississippi town, the same place where A Time to Kill was set with some of the same characters, including the same lead character. And he's doing a variety of people, black people, white people, old people, young people, men and women. And none of it ever feels fake to me. It's a really astonishing voice performance, and I absolutely was so impressed by it. Not everybody is a Grisham person. I totally get it. But I really enjoyed it, and it was a really good way to experience this particular book, and I liked it a lot. Michael Beck reading John Grisham's Sycamore Row. Very nice. Good.
Great.
And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can, as of recently,
last week.
Follow Bob Mondello. It's Bob_Mondello.
Oh, Grandpa.
You're not just yelling out of windows anymore.
Bob_Mondello. You can follow our pal Trey Graham at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, R-E-E-D-Y. Don't forget the underscore in her name either. You can follow our also producer, Nick Fountain, Nick like Nick, Fountain like Fountain. You can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week after the Oscars. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. There are lots of other NPR podcasts worth checking out, including Snap Judgment with Glenn Washington. Snap is storytelling with a beat, an intimate and musical kind of storytelling. Stories that connect, captivate, and invite you to listen closely. That's Snap Judgment. Find it on iTunes under podcasts.